Yeah.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is BC Radio Live with Philip and Eric, live online at blogtalkradio.com/BC Radio. Aloha! Welcome to BC Radio Live for Wednesday, March 19th. We have an unbelievably packed wall-to-wall, not a second to spare show for you tonight with music and film expected to stay. First up is New York City indie producer and musician Martin Beatty. His most recent album is Sirens of the Apocalypse. We'll also talk with punk rock and roll band The AKAs about their new album, just released yesterday, Everybody Makes a Noise. Shifting to film, DC Magazine's very own Lucas McNally will be on the show talking about his short film, Gravidas. Finally, we'll talk with Mark Crutier, producer and director of the documentary Westinghouse. The chat room is now open at blogtalkradio.com/BC Radio, and the live video feed is now running. I am Philip Wynn, Chief Geek at BC Magazine, and I am joined tonight by Eric Olson, founder and publisher of BC Magazine. Hello, Eric.
Hello, don't have time to talk.
That's true. Also with us tonight is Lisa McKay, the executive editor of BC Magazine. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you. Hi, guys.
Hi, Lisa.
Well, hi, Eric.
As Eric mentioned, we both mentioned, it is a pretty crammed show tonight, so let's get right to it. I'm going to play a little sample of music, and we'll jump right to the first guest.
Nature always holds. All your friends have come out.
Hey, come on!
Mrs. Big Hat with Mr. Funny Pants and the boy with the elf face. They've all come to see your smile dance, 'cause you have a smile that can always hide the smallest thoughts. You have the loneliest moment that I never could see. Just breathing me, you have the loneliest moment.
That was Goth Chick 98 from Martin Beatty from his latest album, Sirens of the Apocalypse. Martin has been an indie fringe record producer since 1981. He's worked with artists from Iggy Pop, The Ramones, and White Zombie to John Zorn, Herbie Hancock, and Sonic Youth. Welcome to BC Radio Live, Martin.
Hi, Philip. How you doing?
I'm doing very well. It's good to have you on the show.
Well, thank you.
Martin, hello. It's Eric Olson. Great to talk with you.
Hey, Eric.
I've been getting your emails about your regular over the long haul performances since we worked with you. I wish I would have done the interview, but all the way back to the Encyclopedia of Record Producers.
Right, right.
And our mutual friend Paul Verna interviewed you for that.
Oh, that's right. I do remember that now. I mean, I remember the Encyclopedia and stuff. I kind of forgot about the interview.
It's 9 years ago. I can't even believe it. But yeah, that's where I first heard of you, and he did a great job, and it's so interesting, and I don't want to take too much time, but I also don't want to take time away from your current project. I'm not sure if you want to talk about that first, or just a brief capsule of your amazing journey through the Brooklyn underground involving some real greats, Bill Laswell, of course, and Material.
Yeah.
And if you want to just tell us maybe how you got into it. You're a producer, you're an engineer, you're a musician, and just been a kind of a keystone of that, of the uptown sound? Downtown?
I forget
which part of town.
Yeah, well, downtown, I guess. In the early days, there really was an uptown, and that was like the early hip-hop stuff. I really kind of just drifted with the wind. The one important choice I made was to not go to college, actually. It was just, I just jumped right into music. That, I think, was the best choice, because my drifting in the wind actually kind of landed in a few good places. There was a lot going on in the late 70s, very late 70s, 79, pretty much the 80s. And I was lucky enough, especially at that age, you know, you just kind of drift into things. And also at that age, like literally starting into music around 17, with the enthusiasm and the sort of, you know, wide open, you know, like a blank slate in my brain of what I could do, I pretty much just did, as I do now, is whatever I can, You know, I'm creative. Whatever needs to be done, I kind of, you know, like even that the song, the clip you guys just played, Goth Chick 98. What's funny about that is it's really nothing like the rest of the record, but it's sort of like, oh, here's this niche of stuff that's going on. I felt like being referential to it. It's just like an opportunity, an act of opportunity. So really, when I started in, when I was 17, there was definitely no plan of being a record producer. So it was really like, what can I do? And I realized pretty quickly that I could almost show up at any local show and, you know, some of my favorite local bands and just offer to do live sound, and pretty much always the answer was yes. And so those bands turned out to be like Lounge Lizards, DNA, James Blood Ulmer, you know, so like good stuff. And I realized there was a need and I filled it. And then sooner or later I was like, well, maybe some people would like to record. And, you know, little by little that just led to the right people because, you know, I was, you know, taking some action, I guess. And there wasn't a lot of recording action at that time. It was pretty much, you know, the major leagues and humongous studios or people just taping things at shows live. No one was really doing a lot of multi-track recording, you know.
As I understand it, a real turning point was when Eno came in. You were doing sound for, was it a Material show?
Yeah, that was Material. I can't remember if he'd been, because he kind of poked around a bunch, meaning he would just kind of show up, and I can't remember if he was poking around a lot. I can't remember if it was the first show that he attended, but one of the shows he just kind of stood by me, sort of behind me.
Lurking.
What's that?
Lurking.
Lurking and kind of watching, and I think he referred to my job, but I turned around and he just kind of stared at me and said, "Brilliant." Absolutely brilliant. And at the time, and I thought he was talking about me. Since then, I've kind of thought maybe he just thought the show was brilliant, but I don't know. For a few years, I kept thinking he thought my live sound was brilliant. But actually, you know, I met him the next day for tea. He seemed interested. But he was really interested in the whole scene back then. I mean, good thing that he latched onto us. It's funny because us, Material, we were definitely a little more, well, I guess we could say proggy now, or a little more like serious music, in quotes, you know? I mean,
well, very arty, really.
Yeah, very arty, because when you think of the other things that were catching people's ear was either sort of dysfunctional jazz, like James Chance and the Contortions.
That's a great term, dysfunctional.
Or dysfunctional noise indie rock, like,
right,
like DNA. And, like,
and
you know,
funk, but the funk element, too.
And funk? Did you say funk or punk?
Yeah, I said, and you had a funk element as well.
Yeah, it was funk. Well, that's because Bill, with Laswell, his background was in funk. I mean, when he was a kid, he was playing in funk bands for, like, dances and stuff. So, you know, he that's where he had his, you know, he had his funk chops, of course, and he was, like, bringing that into it. And, you know, Bill had a real interest in finding great musicians, which was a little different than what was really happening on the Lower East Side then. The Lower East Side then with punk and no wave was kind of all about attitude and very confrontational, and that's cool. It's just that, you know, Bill had a different take on it. And that's also what made Bill a little, well, what we were doing, a little suspect and outsider from everything else. You know, people like Lydia Lunch, it was about attitude. It wasn't really about, like, you know, hitting all the notes, you know?
Sure, sure. Well, because we're so pressed here and we don't want to leave out key periods, you ended up running, owning and running, just a legendary studio, and as far as I know, you still do, right? In Brooklyn, that's BC?
Yeah, I still have it. I mean, I'm trying to make the place go through some changes, but I still do it and still have it.
And there are pictures of it, the legendary BC, at martinbc.com. I'm looking at them right now. Looks very stark and cave-like. I've heard of, there's all kinds of winding tunnels and whatnot in there.
Oh, yeah. It's an amazing space in that sense. People get lost, go around the wrong corner, go up the wrong stairs. I'm just very lucky. I mean, everyone continuously refers to it as the basement, but it's actually not a basement, thankfully, you know, because of humidity and all kinds of other issues.
Right.
It's really the first floor, but essentially it feels like a basement, but old walls, cryptic in every sense of the word, I guess. And, you know, that's great for vibe. It's also great for sound, because all those large rooms, which aren't, like, scientifically, you know, designed, they actually benefit from imperfections, you know, the walls being kind of crooked and weird. And
what do you do about the about echo, though? I would think you'd have to damp or something?
Well, that's that suits my personality because I tend to go for a more ambient, spacious sound.
I like that too, actually.
That suits some tastes more than others. And I try to rein it in because that's the kind of thing that shouldn't be just unbridled. And that's also the kind of thing that goes in and out of, like, taste, in and out of fashion.
Sure.
So the 80s was fine all about that, and then there was this sort of anti-ambience forces that gathered. And
the dry tones.
And then, again, everything kind of dried up. Like, I remember even in New York, it was, like, really the almost anti-80s contingent. Like, people like John Spencer and stuff like that had a very un-80s sound. It was supposed to be kind of dry. It was almost going back to more like what the 70s were like.
Right.
The 70s.
Right.
You know, they were fighting that sort of, like, overproduced, over-big, overhyped sound that the 80s. But the 80s, that kind of suited my brain a little. I like things being a bit bigger than life, you know.
So just so we can move on to the record, because I really want to make sure we get to that and talk about it. What can you tell me? I hate to put you on the spot. Maybe just two or three. I mean, what are your absolutely most memorable productions? What really stands out in your mind?
Well, recent stuff, just because of maybe personal reasons, I would have to say the Dresden Dolls from the recent crop. I think the reason that's a favorite is because it had such a grassroots.
A big hit, too. Pretty big hit, right?
I would say. I mean, I don't know, but big.
For the field.
Yeah, well, big for the field. I mean, I'm not even sure it's as big as Gogo Bordello is now, for instance, but definitely approaching that, you know? And it seemed very grassroots. It seemed like people were really inspired, and it was a little bit more than just about the music. People seemed to see some. And when I say people, I do mean very young people, and that actually was kind of exciting to me, too, because it seemed like there was a real passion there. And I kind of realized that's always what motivated me, you know, as a producer, was sort of like the social context of what we were doing. Even though no wave stuff, like I said, about having being about attitude and stuff like that, it had a social context that was sort of exciting, and it had something to say, you know.
All right, well, let's talk about this. This is a really interesting recording. I love the packaging. Wow, it's really beautiful. Is that the same woman throughout?
Yes, it is.
Who is she?
This woman, Ego Sensation, who does, like, performance art in New York, and I've known her for a little while. I've also recorded various bands that she's in. She's in this band, White Hills.
She is a changeling.
Well, it's funny because I had no thought of. I was originally going to have a different woman for each picture, you know, because each picture relates to a specific song, and you can actually find the title, like, woven into the picture.
Right.
Carefully, like Where's Waldo or whatever, you know.
Hand scripted.
Yes, exactly. And I was going to do a different woman for each picture, and I just stood there, sat there in one of her performances as she went through all these different personas and changed clothing, and I was like, you know what? Maybe that's just a perfect convenience. Maybe it's a great concept to have it all be the same woman, like morphing. And it's actually, well, it's also convenient, keeps it simple.
Yeah.
All be one person instead of hiring, you know, 10 models or something, you know?
I think it's very fitting. It's very apt. And you really do have to think about it to realize that it is the same person. I mean, you got to really concentrate on the face because her hair changes and the outfits change and the attitude changes. And so, of course, that relates to the fact to the essence of this, which is this is a series of encounters, more or less real life, I would imagine, fictionalized to a certain extent,
right,
that you've had with women over the years, right?
Yeah, exactly. Fictionalized, because, you know, it's the usual thing with songwriting. It starts with a simple context that's on your mind, and then you kind of make it a little bigger and amplify it. And, you know, of course, I guess like all fiction, really, but everything sort of has a true root, not because I really intend to, it's just that I found myself, you know, my mind, especially it's the issue of women and gender relations and all that stuff, that's the stuff that seems to occupy so much of the brain time, you know?
Yes, of us all, you know? I mean,
yeah, so
who can escape?
Yeah, exactly, and definitely not me. So I'm just, you know, I just, all the songs, I didn't intend to write a song where all the women, all the songs had a central female theme, but then I kind of realized that they all did, and they were all different. It was all different kinds of women or a different kind of slant. And the record, and that also represents the fact that the record was done over like 8 years, so there's a lot of people I've met and, you know, a lot of women I've met.
It's kind of an expanded 88 lines about 44 women. You remember that one?
What was that?
it was a song back, originally, it was done by a few people, but I think it was originally The Nails, and it was this really minimalist electro background, and the guy just chants two lines each for 44 women, and it's real bouncy. It was 80s, kind of late 80s. It's really funny, but it's also, you know, kind of terrifying. I mean, it's just this whole range of women. Imagine 44 women, you know, every kind of personality, and there's just two lines to each, and it ends up being a song. It's really quite funny. And
the band was The Nails. I bet you can find it on YouTube. Let me jump in here. We're coming pretty close to the end. I want to play another clip from the album. I don't know if you want to say anything about this, Martin. This is Mary Magdalen.
Well, actually, I kind of would, because Mary Magdalen is a take on Mary Magdalene, you know, Jesus' pal. And so the idea, and it's funny because the photographer, this woman, Tasia, who took the picture of Mary Magdalene in the artwork, sort of elaborated, yes, she's saintly and sluttish. I forget exactly the word she used, but unaware of both. And you can see it in the artwork. It's this girl who's sort of divine and profane at the same time, unaware. And that's what it's based on.
That is quite a dichotomy. I love that.
Yeah. That's for as dichotomous as you could get, I guess.
Mary Magdalene Park is remarkable for me. And it's my destiny that she legendary in this little sleepy mall where I pulled my car in for lunch. She posts on by and says,
why don't you try ham and cheese?
But I want her and I want to taste her butter and I want a little peach like her to lick me up and down, you see. The sacred wind of time and the Surgeon General won't mind.
And that's Mary Magdalene.
Super cool and trippy. Do you have a favorite woman, Martin? And then we have to move on.
A favorite woman?
Of the bunch?
Of the bunch? Oh, Buddhist Girl is my favorite one, I suppose.
Cool, that's a great song. People are just going to have to pick it up to check it out. Now, I see the release parties aren't until May, is that right?
That's right, to coincide with the street date when it'll be in stores.
Ah, so it's not out till May.
It's available digitally now, you know, on iTunes and stuff, and then stores a little later.
Okay, well, let's send them to your site. It's probably the easiest address is martinbc.com. From there, they can get your MySpace and your YouTube, right?
Yes.
And you do an audio blog, right?
That's right, and that's also a podcast on iTunes, the same thing. The podcast is called Music Nations.
Excellent. Well, we encourage everyone to check out martinbc.com, and we really appreciate the time. Thanks so much for coming on. Congratulations on your tremendous career, even if you didn't intend for it to be so.
Yeah.
It's really quite impressive in aggregate, and I love the record. You know, I mean, we're talking kind of weird and disjointed, but in a very interesting and intelligent and artistic way.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Eric and Philip. That's awesome.
Excellent. We'll talk to you again, Martin. Thanks.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Well, Sirens of the Apocalypse is available now digitally. You can find a link to it on Amazon at blogtalkradio.com/BC Radio, or do check out Martin's website. That's martinbc.com. The AKAs are everywhere. Their new album, Everybody Makes Some Noise, was just released yesterday, I believe. Let's start with a clip from their new single, Dead Flowers Forever. Well, that was Dead Flowers Forever from the AKAs, and we've got some of them on the phone here to talk with us about the new album. Welcome to BC Radio Live.
Hey, guys. What's up? This is Mike.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing well. I think we've got Josie on the line as well.
Oh, I hope so.
Am I on the line?
You are.
You are.
Oh.
We have Mike E. and Josie Outlaw from the AKAs.
Yes.
Hi, guys. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am super. And first of all, let me publicly say I completely screwed up last week, and I publicly apologize. These guys called in. We were already doing an interview, and Gary from Ravy said they were frightened. They were scared away. They didn't know what to do. They ran away. And, man, that makes me feel bad. So, anyway, I really do apologize about that.
No,
but really glad
no
you
worries.
Could make it.
I actually learned a lot about Facebook.
Yeah, I bet you did. More than you needed to know. Yeah, you heard this rather proper Texas woman talking about her Facebook experience. And I bet that fit right in with your daily lives.
Yeah, no. Well, before we go on, no worries. And thank you guys so much for having us on. We're super excited. And it's definitely awesome. Especially, it's very timely because the record did come out yesterday. So we're excited.
I've heard that. And you know what? Just before the show, I was sitting here and I listened to the whole thing all the way through. And I really love it. It's super, it's energetic, it's tuneful, it is rocking. And I really do hear the comparison. I mean, I really do hear the combination of the 60s, keyboard bass, the Farfisa sound, or electric piano, and with the 80s punk, of course, and put together and brought up to date, and it's really good. Good vocals and excellent playing, and I really enjoy it.
Cool. Thank
awesome.
You very much.
Thanks.
So where were you guys? Now, I heard something about Erie, PA, which is only like, what, 90 miles from here? I'm in the Cleveland area.
Oh, yeah. I actually, we played there. We played a record release show there on Sunday. And Erie is actually my hometown. So
you and the Wonders.
We just watched that movie today.
Did you really?
Yeah.
I am vibing on you heavily.
That's crazy. It was just on cable today. And, that's nuts. And Cleveland is, when I was growing up in Erie, there was really not a lot of music going on. So we would go to Cleveland, Buffalo, or Pittsburgh for shows. So Cleveland is where I saw my first real show and did my first stage dive.
Whoa, who was it?
It was, the show was The Circle Jerks in 7 Seconds.
Wow, now that's some classic punk.
Yeah.
Some classic West Coast punk.
Yeah, it was an awesome show. I was 13 or 14 and completely horrified, but super stoked.
I can imagine. Wow. Well, get this. I DJ'd a frat party at UCLA that the Circle Jerks played at.
Whoa, that's crazy.
How was that? Yeah, that was my crazy 80s. Yeah, I was a DJ in L.A. We did a lot of college parties and a lot of showbiz parties and stuff. We'd often work with bands, and I was always trying to bring in the craziest bands we could find. And we did this one annual party at a frat. It was their punk party, and so every year they had a real punk band. And I remember working with the Circle Jerks. Yeah, Morris. What's his first name?
Keith
Morris, yeah. And he worked at a record store right down the street, too. Man, it is a small world.
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah, right on. So, cool. Well, Cleveland rocks.
Ian Hunter said that.
Yeah, right on.
So now, let's tell. The record is out now, right? It's on Metropolis, and it's available?
Yeah, you can get it in stores as of today, well, as of yesterday, and it's on iTunes, and, yeah, it's everywhere.
Excellent.
Of course, the link from blogtalkradio.com/BCRadio as well, so that people can buy it from Amazon if they want.
And as always, we want to refer, you guys have a bunch of sites going on, you got the MySpace and everything, but probably the easiest for people to remember is you're at www.theakas.com. And in fact, I'm looking at the tour link right now. It looks like you got a really big tour coming up starting the 25th in State College.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you
want to
talk about that, Josie?
Well, we're starting out in State College, and we're routing out to do Bamboozle Left in California. We're going to be playing on the second day, April 6th. So we'll be doing that, and then we meet up with a band called The Phenomenauts, and we'll be doing a whole, I think, 6-week tour with them.
Yeah, all the dates aren't posted yet, so they're still coming in.
Wow. Well, oh yeah, I see that, right. And yeah, that's a jam-packed tour. You guys are going to be out for quite a while.
Yeah, then that ends in California, so we still are going to have to route back home, and then we do the last half of Warped Tour. So the rest of our lives are cashed in until the end of summer.
Wow. Well, there's worse things if you're a working band, you know?
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
There are worse things than to be working. Now, where are you guys based now?
We're out of Philadelphia right now.
Ah. Who's from Philadelphia?
Well, actually, none of us are from Philadelphia.
Of course.
But that's where we all live now. We're all from different areas. Like, I grew up in New Jersey and South Jersey, and Mike's from Erie, Pennsylvania. But, like, we have, our bass players from Texas and our drummers from Minneapolis and stuff. So we really are everywhere.
We're from everywhere, at least.
And,
yeah.
And that's part of the name. Very apt.
When we ended up with this lineup of people, we were living in South Jersey, and we all ended up living in this tiny little house together, and that was an extreme experience. So, in some forms of that lineup, we lived there for like 2 years. So, Philadelphia was a really good nearby city. We all, we started the band in New York City, and we're just kind of needing to get back in more of an urban environment. We were living in the middle of nowhere. So, that's actually one of the things that I think is kind of inspiring and interesting about the record, is that living in those kinds of conditions, we were at kind of one of the most miserable points of our musical and life careers. So, we ended up writing what we think is a pretty proactive, positive, like, inspiring record. So that's pretty cool.
It is. It's very positive. It's very, very up. It's not, Pollyanna-ish or anything. And obviously you got you kind of got the ragged edge of the punky feel. But yeah, it's very positive. There's a lot of movement to it. Everything moves forward. One song really just leads into the next, and it all fits together really well. What I was thinking of, it's not that you sound like it, but it was reminding me of one of the real good, any number of the really good Ramones albums, where just one just blows right into the next one, And you guys,
that's awesome.
It's not the same sound, because you guys have a lot more of the keyboard. And that's you, right, Josie? You're the keyboard player?
Yeah, that's me.
How did you arrive at that combination? It's fairly unusual these days. It's almost like I was thinking of like the Flesh Tones, or remember early Green on Red out of L.A.? They had a keyboard dominating sound too, but in a punky kind of feel.
Yeah, well, the keyboard that I use is like an old Farfisa organ.
I knew it. I said that.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. I guess it's just, we just wanted more of like a cool like 60s sound with like, more modern stuff with it. I don't know. I don't really know how to.
We mix it up. Like, I think the first record was Farfisa on the whole thing, but this record we took it as an opportunity to kind of mix it up. So there's like,
yeah, we use a couple of different sounds. Like, we have like a piano on one song too, and then more of like a synth sound on another song. So it's a little mix of everything.
It's very well produced. Who's the producer on this?
Alex Newport.
Yeah, he's got some pretty big credits, doesn't he?
Yeah, he did At the Drive-In and
Mars Volta.
Yeah,
those are the kind of ones he's most known for.
That's interesting. They're pretty different from you.
Yeah, well, I think that what's cool about Alex is that he's kind of most notable for, like, he's kind of an old school, like, stubborn-minded guy where he doesn't use a lot of like modern like digital stuff. I mean, he still records that way, but he's got an old school attitude, and his approach is really to capture the energy of a band, and that was something that was really important for us, because going into a record, if we made a record that just sounded really clean and pretty, like, it's just not gonna, it would be like a bad new wave record. So we wanted to really do what we could to capture the energy and the urgency of our live show and keep it kind of loose and and rough, and he really understands that. So that was a cool marriage to work with him. And you know, we did a lot of stuff that we've never done as a band before. When we recorded like live as a full band just to get the drum tracks, and you know, took a lot of takes just because we were playing it too well. a lot of times he would stop, and he's very British, and he would be like, "It's too perfect. Play it again."
play it again with errors.
A little crappier, yeah. So we were
drop it up.
Ready to strangle him at points.
Well, that's the ideal band producer relationship.
Exactly. You don't pay somebody to pat you on the back and tell you that you're doing awesome. So he definitely motivated us in several unique ways.
Well, I think it came out really well. It really did. That really is a one of the several kind of key approaches that producers take. I don't know if you were listening when we were talking to Martin, but I was the editor and kind of the head writer of the Encyclopedia Record Producers, so I did, I mean, literally hundreds of interviews, and kind of one of the threads that ran through was a lot of these guys, their whole approach was to, in a sense, irritate people, you know, irritate the band, because they thought they wouldn't be complacent then, kind of keep them on edge, and maybe come up with new things. They may do something literally just out of anger with the producer that would be new and different, and, you know, just to keep people on edge. I think there's directors who, you know, who approach actors that way, too.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And that, I mean, I guess I've never thought of it, like, straight up that way, but that was his thing.
Definitely did that.
Now you both do other things, right? Mike, you're a tattoo artist, and
yes.
Josie, you have a cosmetics line, right?
Yeah, I just started my own cosmetics line a couple months back, and it's called Red Letter Girl. It has like all like animal friendly products. Nothing's tested on animals, and nothing comes in like actual like boxes or packaging. It all has like little cosmetics pouches, so it's all like eco-friendly and nothing like to throw away and everything. So,
cool. Well, where can people find it? I think you have a MySpace page.
Yeah, I have a MySpace page. It's myspace.com/redlettergirl, and I'll have a website up soon. It's going to be redlettergirlcosmetics.com.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Mike,
yeah.
You're Mr. Tattoo?
That's Dr. Tattoo. No,
oh, sorry.
yeah, I've been tattooing for years, and I also do design and artwork and design. And
do they allow that in Erie?
No, there's none of that in Erie. No, that's why I moved away. I keep busy. I've done stuff I do mostly music stuff with the design stuff. I've done stuff for, you know, a lot of bands like Fall Out Boy, My Chemical Romance, and some big stuff like that. But tattooing's awesome because it's something that, well, both of the things are, and same with Josie, we've, you know, because bands don't often make any money anymore. We're kind of forced to come up with unique and creative ways to maintain a full-time touring schedule. So it's cool because we can all kind of make our own schedules and, you know, work from the road. And I bring my stuff with me and end up tattooing in the backs of clubs or, you know, hotel rooms overnight and stuff like that. So
how cool.
Yeah.
Well, I wish we had more time.
We'll bring them back.
Yeah, we have a packed show, but I would actually like to spend more time chatting.
Yeah. We'll
in the meantime, though.
Anytime.
Cool.
Good luck with the tour and the record. I think it's really great.
Awesome.
Yeah,
thanks
so much.
We'll
see you in Cleveland.
That would be super. Yeah. When are you going to be here?
They're coming to Denton actually very, very soon. That's just right up the road from me down here in Texas. So.
Oh, you were just at Peabody's in February, end of February.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we'll definitely be back. There isn't a date posted yet, but I know we're playing in Cincinnati, so there's got to be a Cleveland date right after.
All right. Well, good luck with the tour, you know, and with the cosmetics and with the tattooing and all that cool lifestyle stuff. And I hope you even make some money and everything.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Well, if everyone buys our record, that would help.
There you go.
They should. Everyone should.
Everybody Makes Some Noise is the name of the new album from the AKAs, and you can order it from Amazon, as usual, at blogtalkradio.com/BCRadio. And check out the band's site at theakas.com. That's theakas.com. Well, at the halfway point in the show, we shift gears to film. Lucas McNally writes a feature for BC Magazine called The Uber Indie Project, and he's got a few award-winning indie projects of his own. His current short film, Gravidas, is a semifinal selection in the online Now Film Festival. Welcome to BC Radio Live, Lucas.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, Lucas.
Hey.
Nice talking to you.
Lisa normally just sits here so quietly and takes it all in, but I think she needs to step forward as co-host here. I know that Lisa is very interested in indie film herself.
Yes, I am, and I'm really glad to have Lucas on the show tonight. Lucas, I want to talk about the film festival and Gravida in specific, but first I just want to go back to something that you mentioned to me yesterday, which is that you're a self-taught filmmaker, which I find very interesting. And you started making films in college. So how did you happen to fall into filmmaking?
It was a really interesting thing. I was in radio, actually, and I had to take a required video course just to graduate. And the school said, hey, we're going to do a film festival senior year. And I decided, gee, that might be fun. It'll be a good way to learn video. And I made a film, and I really kind of fell in love with it.
Wow. So
I pretty much spent my senior year doing that.
That's
yeah.
cool. So did that make you change your major, or did you just
it was final semester and I really didn't want to
project.
I didn't really want to back up and start all over again.
That's very cool. So what did you actually major in then?
I ended up majoring in broadcasting.
Oh, well, that's
and
not.
I did mostly
and here you are.
Yeah. Finally.
So tell us a little bit about Gravida. It's an absolutely wonderful little film. I really enjoyed it. The Now Film Festival is an online film festival, and tell us a little bit about how that works and what it means for you to have the film selected as a semifinalist in that
okay.
process.
There are 25 semifinalists, and it's been running since November, I believe. And what happens is every week they choose a semifinalist, and then it's featured on YouTube and MySpace for a week. And then they stay on YouTube and MySpace and on the webpage. And at the end of 25 weeks, there's a big voting period, and a certain number of finalists, which I believe is somewhere in the neighborhood of 10, has a screening in Hollywood at one of the Academy studios, or the Academy theaters. And then the winner gets a camera package of some kind.
Wow, that's very neat.
Yeah.
So what kind of payoff is there for a filmmaker to get a short film, shown in a venue like that?
Really, the big payoff at this point, unless you win the camera package, which has a pretty obvious payoff, is you get that exposure. Gravida has so far been seen, I think, like 21,000 times on MySpace and YouTube, and in comparison, we've printed 100 DVDs, and we haven't sold all of those yet. So the jump in exposure is pretty huge for us.
Huge. Talk a little bit about the film itself. How did it come about? I was going to ask you to talk about the process from conception to completion, but I thought the pun was a little too obvious. Tell us the story.
It started, I had insomnia, and that's usually where I get my good ideas. And I had this image of the old like 18th century or 19th century erotica photos where you have a woman from behind, and she's sort of sitting on a bed, and it was this really beautiful shot. And I thought would be really interesting would be to build a film around that moment, which looks so calm and peaceful and erotic, and sort of build a really horrible scenario around that, where that instant is the only beautiful moment there.
Mm.
And so it started as this whole big thing about photography. And then we found out that we couldn't find an actress who was talented enough and good-looking enough to pull it off in the city, except for one, but she was pregnant. And so it wouldn't work. And then in the process of talking to her about it, we ended up switching it to a pregnant woman, which solved all sorts of plot problems I had. And really, it went from there. And then Rachel Shaw, the actress, spent about a month going back and forth with me on the script and explaining to me, first of all, what women think and what they feel about scenarios, and then how that changes with a pregnancy.
Ah, that's very interesting to hear, because one of the things that occurred to me as I was watching the film was how you sort of got pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought that came through loud and clear, but it's very interesting to hear that you got a lot of feedback from her through that process.
Yeah, I would have been not good.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think, yeah, men don't have that advantage. But so how hard is it to work in a short form? I know I've heard writers say that short stories are much harder to do than novels because you've got such a little time to kind of accomplish.
Right.
So what are some of the challenges in telling at least part of a story in such a short period of time? The runtime on this is what, 24?
Yeah, it's like 22, 24 minutes, somewhere in there. I think the trick for this was to get rid of all of, because normally if you were going to do a feature, I think you would have the scene where she gets pregnant and the guy leaves, and then you would have a scene at the end, and sort of the idea was to strip all of that away and say, what do we absolutely fundamentally need to tell the core story,
mm-hmm.
which is her coming to terms with her pregnancy, and then do as much as you can of the other stuff with just hints of it. And really, I mean, you can have the scene where she gets pregnant and the guy leaves, but I mean, we can figure out that's happened. I mean, she's pregnant, we get it.
Yeah.
We don't really need that. And it fleshes out and it'll do more with her character, but you have to sort of figure out ways to do that quickly.
Yeah. Well, so short films haven't traditionally had much of a life beyond the festival circuit. And you
right.
mentioned before that this is getting seen a lot because it's online. And do you think that the internet is going to become sort of a final destination for filmmakers at any point in the near future?
Oh, yeah. I think it'll be a destination for feature films as well, and you're already starting to see a little bit of that. The Four-Eyed Monsters is a feature film that I believe is showing on YouTube in its entirety, and I think you're going to see, I'd like to see people go into shorts a little bit more, because the trend now seems that people are making shorts to show someone that they can make a feature. And not everyone's doing that, but a lot of people are doing that. And you can, you know, there's a lot of really great short story writers, to use your example, who never felt or rarely felt the need to go into a novel and
right.
could tell beautiful stories in a short form. So I'd like to see the internet sort of become a means for that.
Yeah, I think it would be the perfect venue for such a thing. What are you working on right now? Do you have more short films in the hopper? Do you have a feature length film in your future? What is happening?
I'm working on a feature length script about a cinephile who sort of comes to realize that his life doesn't have to be a tragic Bergman film. And I'm working on a web serial that I may or may not end up doing about a guy who's in a battle of wits with a cat.
He'll lose.
Yeah, he'll lose.
He'll lose all those battles at our house, I can tell you that.
Yeah, I do too.
Working with animals, that seems like a big step.
Yeah, we had some animals on this short by accident, and it ended up working out really well. We had the location, the big location. We got it, and my friend said, well, I'm going to be out of town. You have to feed the cats. And I said, well, yeah, sure, we can do that. And then they wouldn't stay out of the way, so we just put them in shots when we needed them. And it really added, I think, a nice dimension.
Let's see. So, short films, looking at the internet as sort of a marketplace for that, I think is a very exciting idea. Now, you're based in where, Pittsburgh?
Pittsburgh, yes.
Pittsburgh. So, you've got a production company, Depress Productions.
Right.
When you st- start out with a project? I mean, where do you begin? How do you go about getting people to work on your film?
It's kind of a network of people. My first step is I sort of flesh out the idea, and I have a couple of people who I go to who are under strict orders to not, you know, pander at all to me and to tell me if any idea is even remotely bad,
uh-huh.
and to sort of be really, really, really harsh with me. And then it's a thing where you just go out and talk to people who you've seen in other projects. I do some theater stuff in the city, and I usually get actors from the theater scene because I figure a theater actor can carry themselves over the course of a film maybe better than someone who's just starting to learn film acting.
Yeah.
Because they have all that training, and when you're working on a budget and you don't have a whole lot of time, if you can get an actor who's not going to need as many takes as were, then that's a lot. That's a big help.
Yeah.
What did this film cost?
This film cost around $2,500.
Well, that's reasonable.
Yeah.
Figured out by the minute, man. Whoa,
yeah,
that is
about $100 a minute. Pretty impressive.
About $100 a minute, yeah. And most of that was renting lights.
Amazing.
Because it was such a low light scenario, we needed a lot of specific stuff.
Yeah, you know, I was mentioning before the show or in the chat room, actually, I guess, that I watched this about a week and a half ago, and I was just, as we were talking, going through nowfilmfestival.com, hint, and seeing it there again. And it really is a beautiful, beautiful film. I mean, it just seems like almost every scene is lit perfectly for photography, which is what I usually notice. Very nicely done.
Yeah, and all the credit to that would go to Dave Egger and Don Yockey, who did the cinematography. And the lighting, the big light that everyone always talks about is there's a red light in the final scene.
Right.
And that was 1,000% their idea. They sort of finished lighting the room, and I walked in, and I went, what is that? And they went, trust us, it'll look great. And I sort of looked at them, you know, like they had lost their minds. And I said, well, we'll see. And then
film,
it worked
a
out
collaborative process.
Yeah, it's so collaborative, and you have to be able to let people to do that stuff. And people keep saying, oh, I love the red light. It means this and it means that. And I'm like, yeah, sure.
It's the red light district.
It is. It's a little bit of the red light district.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we are very much out of time. We're definitely trying to cram things in here. I'm glad we were able to get you on, though, Lucas.
Well, he can stay on. We're talking with another filmmaker.
Absolutely. Hang out. Maybe you can pop
in
with a question as well. Do check out Lucas's film, Gravida, on nowfilmfestival.com. Lucas also does write for DC Magazine, so at blogcritics.org you'll definitely find links to Lucas hither, thither, and yon.
Congrats on that, on the film, Lucas. That's really quite an achievement.
Thank you so much.
Well, Mark Bussler is the producer and director of the feature-length documentary Westinghouse about the life and times of George Westinghouse. Let's jump right to it. Welcome to DC Radio Live, Mark.
Well, thank you. I'm based out of Pittsburgh, too. This is a small world.
Whoa! It was meant to be.
That was a little weird when I saw the phone numbers lighting up the caller ID, and I thought, oh, no, this is strange. These area codes overlap.
Do you know each other?
No, we don't.
No, not really, no.
But that could change.
Good.
Well, Lucas is probably a little earlier in the process than you are, Mark, right? You started probably somewhat similarly. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but
actually, I've been listening to the entire show so far, and somewhat similar. I'm also fairly self-trained, and I've been doing filmmaking for about 10 years now. But I got started off doing internet broadcasting work, and migrated into documentaries.
Interesting. Why don't you just tell us a little bit more about that path and how you ended up there and. And it's so funny to hear what you just said, you know, not ha-ha funny, but that someone began 10 years ago in internet broadcasting. That just sounds crazy.
Wow, that is strange.
You know?
Yeah, we were
a pioneer, man.
We were early in the game, that's for sure. I came out of school with a business degree in marketing and was self-taught in internet back, you know, this is like 98 when the internet was really big business and everything, you know, when had all the potential before the bubble burst, and the first time around. And came out and was doing industrial film and marketing and advertising and website design, and ended up working for a startup in Pittsburgh doing internet broadcasting work and really low budget internet television stuff. And I was actually doing video game reviews online, and one thing led to another. We ended up the company, which became our distribution and company and studio, Intercom Entertainment. We were doing historical shorts, and we ended up doing documentaries, and then moved into DVD in 2001. And I produced 10 documentaries, about 11 documentaries actually since then.
Wow!
Yeah, I'm looking at the list here. Civil War Minutes. You've got one on the Johnstown Flood. There's Gettysburg, the Horses of Gettysburg, World War One. And then, of course, coming, I believe it's next month, the DVD release of Westinghouse.
Yeah, Westinghouse will be released on April 8th, and that's the latest and I think the greatest. So,
where can people see it? Is it just a clip so far, I would assume, since it's not out yet?
That's the feature-length film. That's the release. It's being released on DVD. So it's everyone always points towards Amazon.com. We've been working with Amazon for nearly a decade.
Oh right, I mean, can they see anything now? I mean, is there a trailer?
Yeah, if you go to YouTube, you can type in Westinghouse. If you go to our website, WestinghouseFilm.com,
there's also the Mark Bussler blog.
Yeah, my blog, which I haven't updated in about a month. I've actually been I'm in limbo. I shouldn't say limbo. I'm in pre-production, which I call limbo because it's all paperwork and phone calls. I'm in pre-production on my next film, but in the meantime, I'm been back and pushing classic video games on the internet again. So it's been about 8 years, but I have a new series back on the internet called Classic Game Room. So, I don't like to sit idle very long.
No, you're a busy guy. Well, let's talk about Westinghouse. How did you end up being interested in him, and what did you learn about him, and what can we look forward to? You know, what revelations will come from the film?
Well, Westinghouse was a very important person, and in fact, in doing the research on the film, I'll get to that in a moment. But I generally found that he is, in my opinion, the most important American of all time that has been lost in history as a person. Yet his name is still famous because people know the name Westinghouse from all the appliances and the companies. But I came across the subject because I had done a film previously on the 1893 World's Fair called Expo Magic of the White City. That's the one that Gene Wilder narrated. And that has done really well for us, and I've just been fascinated in World's Fairs ever since then. So I've been researching the 1939 World's Fair in New York, came across Electro, who was regarded as one of the first robots in the world, and he was like the talking robot for Westinghouse. And I had went over to the George Westinghouse Museum, which is based in Pittsburgh, and talked with the executive director there, and he turned me on to the story of George Westinghouse. So I ended up working in collaboration with the museum, which has since merged with the Heinz History Center in Pittsburgh. But at the time, I'd worked with the George Westinghouse Museum for about 6-7 months on research through their archives, which were very extensive. Lots of paperwork that was from the 30s, written, and a lot of notes and letters written by people who had worked with George Westinghouse in the 1880s and 1890s. George Westinghouse invented the air brake for trains, which was immensely important back in the day for saving the lives of thousands upon thousands of brakemen and expanding the country westward with longer trains. But what he's best known for is pioneering practical alternating current electricity, which is what we use to power our computers and houses and lights and everything today.
And this is where he got into the big raging debate with Tesla and Edison.
Well, Tesla,
he worked with Tesla, big debating with Edison.
Yeah, and they competed with Edison and J.P. Morgan.
And that's probably why we don't know the name of Westinghouse all that well. Edison, well, I mean, I suppose it'll be up to your documentary to help shape people's opinions, but Edison was certainly a better marketer and legal public debater, perhaps even, than he was inventor.
Well, I think Edison is remembered today as one of the historians in the film said, that consummate inventor that all Americans think of. And he was, in my opinion, the pioneer of the modern marketing method, where he was using film, he was using radio, he liked to get out there and talk about himself. He was a real flamboyant celebrity. Westinghouse was a very quiet, reserved engineer. And that's one of the reasons we have so much interest in the film from engineering societies across the United States and technical magazines and inventors. It's because, I mean, Westinghouse was not a dramatic, eccentric person like Howard Hughes or Edison. He was very reserved. He was a normal family guy. He stayed with his wife his whole life. He wasn't out dating movie stars. So his story himself, I mean, he's not the kind of guy you'd make an action film about. But when I got into the documentary and I just saw how exciting everything that he did was, that just turned into a nice film, and especially with the resources that I had to work with. And being that I am based in Pittsburgh and that the majority of the Westinghouse story takes place in Pittsburgh, certainly didn't hurt either.
Very interesting. I see here the synopsis ends with, he was an honest millionaire in the days of robber barons, an optimist in the days of skeptics, and a generous CEO from whom today's executives can learn. That's quite a bit. It sounds like you ended up admiring him quite a lot.
I do. I like the fact that he was a decent person and was still able to accomplish so much of what he did. And he was very humble. And just it's just such an American thing, you know. He wasn't rewarded for being humble at all. In fact, the way history has pretty much forgotten him just shows that we really respect people that are far more flamboyant and self-destructive.
Now, anyway, you know, he might have been. There have been eras of humanity where reserve and decorum were much better appreciated. You know, he might have fit in with the 18th century England or something like that, I suppose. But what was his era? I mean, when did he die?
He died in 1914, and I mean, even at the time, because his workforce loved him. He had in the 1890s, he had his air brake company and the Westinghouse Electric Company. He was employing tens of thousands of primarily immigrant workers in his companies and his factories at the same time when Andrew Carnegie was employing tens of thousands of immigrant workers. Now, Carnegie had his workers working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day without break. They were kept drunk half the time by the local bars. They were not paid well. They were just, they had lots of limbs were cut off. And these people, by the time they were in their 30s, it was said that they were about half dead. Now, George Westinghouse helped his workers get educated. He gave them, he invented the modern day weekend. He gave them Saturdays off, which was unheard of at the time for a major employer. So they had five-day weeks, and they loved him. They built a monument to him in Pittsburgh after his death. So he was very well respected. But in the end, in 1907, one of the key points in the film is that he was such a nice guy and such a generous person that he sort of left himself open to be taken over by some pretty ruthless business people, and actually lost one of his major companies. But He was very well respected, but even then you could see that it was still vicious business people were the ones that were able to take the lead.
Nice guys finish last, unless they're Mr. Westinghouse, I guess, huh? He at least didn't finish last.
His name is one of the most respected names, and it's just that it's not a household name of a person. So I think that's one of the key things in the film is that you know the name Westinghouse, but now you know why you know the name Westinghouse.
Yeah, it's true. We don't use Edison appliances, do we?
Well, you sort of do. You have GE, but that was a trust.
Yeah, the Edison saga. I've looked at that pretty carefully as a quote unquote historian of recording history, and obviously he played a really vital role in early recording. But as much as the invention, what he did, as you mentioned earlier, was he really got out and popularized it, you know.
Well, Edison's phonograph, or the Edison player, what was it called? The cylinders. He invented that right around the same time that Westinghouse was pioneering his air brake and perfecting the automatic air brake. So I actually, there's a nice parallel there between modern interest in gadgets that are fun and exciting and then things that are of industrial nature and actually improve the world. Because the air brake saved thousands of lives and got fairly little press, but the phonograph, of course, was hailed as the greatest invention of all time. And really it was. I mean, it was pretty remarkable.
Well, unfortunately, we are about out of time. I hear the music coming up to let us know we're at the end of our hour. I do appreciate you coming on the show, and I'm actually really looking forward to it. I watched the YouTube trailer earlier today, and I'm really looking forward to the Westinghouse video myself. I'm going to at least rent it, and I'm kind of a science geek, so I may end up picking up a copy of this myself. Well, thank you very much for being on the show, Mark.
Well, thank you very much.
The DVD is due out next month. It is called simply Westinghouse. It is about the life and times of George Westinghouse. It joins Mark Bussler's other documentary DVDs, many of which are available now. Thank you again to Mark Bussler, to Lucas McNally, to Mike C. and Josie Outlaw of the AKAs, and to Monty Beattie, who started off the show with us tonight. Learn more about all of tonight's guests at blogtalkradio.com/DCRadio and learn about other shows on the Blog Critics Radio Network at blogcritics.org/DCRadio. This has been BC Radio Live. We're here every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern. You can subscribe to the podcast to have it delivered to you each week or listen to the audio archives. Until next week, aloha!